Welcome everyone to our camp. Good to have you guys here. We're going to have our first study this morning by John, and he's going to be speaking to us on Tamar's story and Rahab's story. We will just jump straight into it if you want to pop up and talk.
Good morning. I've moved the table nicely forward, but I'm still going to slide back into the darkness because that's kind of where I belong and feel more comfortable. So, our studies this morning are on the general theme of leading ladies. A little word about that last night, but just to let you know why we're doing this, I found in my own personal Bible study, this is an area that I had generally ignored. I mean, I've read the Bible as you have, but I'd never actually studied the women of the Bible in any capacity. I thought it was appropriately deferential that, I mean, who am I as a man to start talking about a woman's story or a woman's experience? That's not really my place. And yet, we have a community where it's the men who are doing the presentations. And as a result, if the men don't speak about the women's stories, well, then if we don't have female speakers, no one's going to speak about them. And they won't be appropriately elevated as the role models that they are clearly capable of being in terms of their examples. Okay, so this morning we're going to have a look at mainly Tamar, but we're going to dip into Rahab's story as well, because Tamar and Rahab are connected. They're connected. They both have that curious little story about a scarlet cord. That's the connection between them. It's very thin, but they've got great stories in their own right. I think it's probably going to be a good idea if we do familiarize ourselves with Tamar's story, because it's a story that's often overlooked because it's fairly depressing. It's Genesis chapter 38, and in order to rest my voice and preserve it for the weekend, I'm going to ask for a volunteer, please, to read it for us. I presume, Sebastian, this microphone can become live as well for someone to... Sweet, it's a thumbs up. And I have a volunteer, Ben. Please. So this is Tamar's story, Genesis chapter 38.
It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her. And she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezib when she bore him. And Judah took for a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then said Judah to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went in to his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up." For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He answered, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." She said, "If you give me a pledge until you send it." And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that's in your hand." So he gave them to her, went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, "Where is the colt prostitute that was at Anaim at the roadside?" And they said, "No colt prostitute's been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I've not found her." Also, the men of the place said, "No colt prostitute has been here." Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." And as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man whom these belong, I am pregnant." And she said, "Please identify whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff." Then Judah identified them and said, "She's more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah." And he did not know her again. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb, and when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took it and tied a scarlet thread on the hand, saying, "This one came out first." But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, "What a breach you've made for yourself." Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah.
Thank you, Ben. First thing we notice about Tamar, she is the first widow in the Bible. And whenever you meet the first occurrence of an important concept in the Bible, it tends to be somewhat of a precedental nature. Things that happen tend to set up a type. So let's look at a summary of Tamar's life that we've just read. Ur's wickedness, that's her husband, Judah's son, prevented her from having a son because God saw that Ur was wicked and killed him. And so then she naturally, according to custom, went to the second brother, and Onan basically refused to raise a son for her. And that would be for financial reasons. If Onan has a son by Tamar, then that son takes over the dead brother's name and the dead brother's inheritance. Onan gets more money for himself if Tamar never has a child, or certainly never has a son. And so he's wickedly motivated by materialism, and he refuses to give her children, and so God kills him too. And Judah, we learn, becomes suspicious, that thinking, what is this woman doing that she's killing all my sons? Judah has difficulty basically telling right from wrong. He's unable to detect he's got wicked sons, and he's unable to detect he's got a righteous daughter-in-law. So he's really not spiritually smart, at least at this point in his life. And so he refuses to give his final third son to Tamar. He makes this excuse that the son isn't old enough, but we're told in the narrative he has no intention of letting Tamar ever marry his third son. In fact, he kicks her out of his house. And he says, "What are you doing living here? Go live with your own father." Understand the depth then of her situation. She is going to outlive her own father. She's no longer married to anyone. Having had two husbands already, she's no longer single and able to be easily married into another family. She is going to starve to death. That's not something that we naturally think of in our society. But as she's gone put back into her father's own house as a younger woman, many years go by and she realizes, my situation is, I am going to die. Judah will not take care of me. And that's the fundamental principle that we learn from this first widow story. Men don't take care of widows. They need the care of God because man doesn't care for them. And being a widow, therefore, is a genuinely crisis situation. That's the spiritual precedent that's set. However, Tamar, I suggest to you, is a very intelligent and cunning woman. And she sets in motion a plan by which she saves her own life. Since Judah won't save her, he's happy to see her die. Let's see how that plan works. And we're going to pay a lot of attention. Thanks very much for that reading, because I wanted us to see those details that come out in the story. Often we read too fast. Well, here am I projecting all my faults on you. Let's start again. Wind back the tape there. Often I read too fast. I just barrel through the chapter. Okay, fine. There's lots of very luscious and juicy details in this text, which are really going to teach us a little bit about what Tamar was doing and how. There's a little speculation involved, particularly at this early stage, but as these seeming coincidences pile up, I think you'll see they're not very coincidental at all. Tamar puts off her widow's garments. Now she's ready to put her plan into action many years down the line. Put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. Enaim. Why Enaim? The place means twin wells. And I'm not going to let you have it easy and just sit there. What do we know about wells in Scripture? Certainly by the time we're in Genesis here, what happens at wells, or what has happened at wells up to now? Women meet together at wells. That's actually true. And shepherds feed their flocks because there's water to be drawn there. That's a very important pattern that's going to come up later. But because the women are there, what happens when the men come there? Women are pushed aside. Well, that's I said, get out of the way. I'm thinking of something more romantic and beautiful, but it's a nice try, David. I'm sure you're right. Exactly. That's... Absolutely. We have a precedent. You're absolutely right, David. We have a precedent that the patriarchs actually meet their wives at wells. It's not like it happened 100 times or anything. But certainly Isaac met, as from Abraham's servant, as you rightly say, Genesis 24, Isaac met his wife essentially at a well, and Jacob also met his wife, per Genesis 29, at a well. Tamar has gone to a place called two wells, twin wells. So you have to ask yourself, is she actually saying, well, I've had two husbands so far, thank you very much, Judah, and a right waste of space they were, spiritually speaking. So here am I at the well a third time because you've given me two husbands and both were so evil that God killed them. Now, that's speculation, but I put it to you, Tamar's an intelligent and thoughtful woman, and that's why she's decided to meet Judah almost in an accusatory way at this place called Twin Wells. And what happens at Twin Wells? There's a deception practiced. When Judah saw Tamar, he thought she was a prostitute because she'd covered herself with a veil. So she's there, covered with a garment, and Tamar says, well, what will you pay me as payment for this sexual activity? And Judah says, I will send you a young goat from the flock. Tamar fools Judah with a goat and a garment, specifically the veil, right? And this, too, is possibly not a coincidence. A goat and a garment. She knows the family story. Where have we seen deception with a goat and a garment? And there's two examples. I heard both of them. Exactly. Let's start with the more recent one. That's what Judah did. Judah deceived his father Jacob with a goat and a garment. Remember, he was trying to convince Jacob that his son Joseph was dead. He has Joseph's coat of many colors, and he rips it up a bit, and he dips it in a young goat's blood, and then says to Jacob, look, fatal accident, I'm afraid, look, with a goat and a garment, he deceived his own father. Poor innocent Jacob, and yet not so much, because poor innocent Jacob once deceived his father, Isaac, with a goat and a garment. specifically with a goat as a garment, if you like, right? You know the story, of course. He puts on the smooth parts of his skin, he pretends to be his hairier brother by using a young goat skin as a garment. So we have Jacob deceiving his father with a goat and a garment, and that comes back to bite him when his own son Judah deceives his father, Jacob, with a goat and a garment. And then we have Tamar, this thoughtful, intelligent woman who knows this family history and says, okay then, watch this. What do we learn? First of all, deception begets deception begets deception. That's a life lesson in its own right, isn't it? The idea of these cycles of you think you can just get away with cheating with deception, it will come back to bite you. And what we notice then, and I think we're beyond the realms of coincidence here, Tamar deceives Judah the deceiver, son of Jacob the deceiver, and with exactly the same tools. She has thought this through. This is truly a leading lady, and yet, and this will be a characteristic for every leading lady in the Bible, you barrel through that chapter and you'll miss the whole lot. All of the lady's achievements, I put it to you now as a postulate, are very quiet. They're spoken, if you like, in a still small voice. And you're going to have to be very attentive. We're going to have to be very attentive as Bible students to notice the brilliance of these women, because it's not going to be as demonstrative as some of the actions of their male counterpart disciples. So then, Judah doesn't have a young goat with him. We wouldn't expect him to. So he says, well, what down payment should I give you in lieu of the young goat we've agreed upon? And Tamar says, well, give me your signet on the cord and give me the staff that is in your hand. Now, what is his signet? That's that sort of ring here. That's literally his legal signature by which he will stamp into wax and sign, or into ink, as sign official documentation. So his signet is his legal identity. And his staff is a sign of authority. That's not my idea, by the way. Don't believe anything I say, that's for sure. That comes straight out of the Bible, that the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. That and other verses will give you the idea that your staff was a sign that you had authority in Israel. So, Tamar has taken away Judah's legal identity and his authority. Well, when Judah refuses to let Tamar marry the one remaining son, Shelah, he has essentially deprived her of any authority or legal identity in Israel. So, Tamar has taken away from Judah what Judah took away from her. So she has cleverly, powerfully, from a position where she has absolutely no social authority or power whatsoever, she has managed to steer circumstances to say, why don't you taste my medicine? Why don't you be in the situation in which you have placed me? I will take away from you what you took away from me. Not as a sense of vengeance. She's trying to save her own life. But on that very theme, when her pregnancy becomes known, then she receives straight away a death sentence from Judah, no less, from the guilty party. Bring Tamar out. She's pregnant by immorality and have her burned to death. Now, at no point in time, and we'll see this in a later study, does God ever, ever approve of anyone being burned to death. The corpses of the guilty were often burned after they'd been stoned or executed in some other way, but under no circumstances. This is a completely immoral and illegal judgment. For one other thing, and I realize the Mosaic law is yet to happen, but in another way, there's been no trial. There's been no evidence. Judah has begun this trial with the death sentence. And that gives you a sense of the depth of the immorality and the inappropriateness of this sentence. Tamar, however, still has power. Because of her intelligence, she is able to unmask the deceiver. And we learn she says to Judah, please determine whose these are, this signet on a cord and this staff. And I pay attention here to the Hebrew word hakana, the idea of examine this. Don't just glance at this, examine this. and see what this really is all about. And what she's showing him is the evidence of his own immorality. That's screamingly obvious. We know that from the story. Why am I stressing on that? I'm stressing that because this word, not a very common word at all, has shown up one time before. And I think this is the author of the Bible, God, who's laying this little symmetry in front of us. And it's rather beautiful, and it's rather shocking in a way. It's what Judah said to his father. He holds up Joseph's coat of many colors, which he's dipped in the goat's blood, and said, "Examine this, Hakana. See whether or not this really is your son's robe." He's asking for an examination, because what he's putting in front of his father is fake evidence of Joseph's death. So the very same important verb that Judah has used to try and convince someone of a fake event is the same word that Tamar shall use to put in front of Judah the evidence of a true event where he has behaved inappropriately and improperly with her. Finally, long time downstream after it should have ever happened, she is more righteous than I. I have sinned. And Judah finally recognizes his crime. Tamar saves herself with this tremendously cunning plan which she's devised over the years. But to some extent, oh great, she's released from the death sentence, thanks. But to some extent, the damage is already done. Not only is the majority of her life over, but she's also now got a curse coming upon her from the law, effectively. No one born of a forbidden marriage, nor any of their descendants, may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even unto the 10th generation. So Judah's immorality, which created that pregnancy, has essentially seen Tamar's line excluded from the assembly of the Lord, from the ecclesia, if you will. For 10 generations, her line is rejected by law for 10 generations for Judah's sin. And it's Judah, at this point, this is the end, really, of Tamar's life and the end, seemingly, of her story. And yet, she will show up again in the life of Ruth. And this is where Ruth plays a very important role. We're not going to look at Ruth this weekend, unfortunately, but we will just glance at this one part of her life because this is where Tamar shows up. Now, the village people of Ruth's day are rejoicing in Ruth's marriage to Boaz and say, "Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman," meaning Ruth, "may your family, Boaz, be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." Why are we talking about Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah? Why are we going back there? Why aren't we going back to Abraham? Or why aren't we going back somewhere else? And may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore. And what Ruth has done by keeping that particular line, which will become the line of Christ, by keeping that line alive, the closing words of the book of Ruth are apparently very boring. It's a genealogy. The son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, and it trails off to the end. And there are a number of feminist analysts of this scripture who get very irate by that, saying, oh, there's just a list of men's name at the end of the book of Ruth. What a shock result. What a silly end. And yet, of course, if we look carefully and put the numbers in, we see that what the end of the book of Ruth, these are the last closing words of the book of Ruth, what they show is actually Ruth's greatest triumph. But of course it's quiet, isn't it? Like all of the actions of the leading ladies. This then is the family line of Perez, born to Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, the second generation, Ram, the third, Aminadab, Nashon, Salmon, 4, 5, and 6, Boaz, the seventh generation, Obed, the eighth, Jesse, the ninth, and Jesse was the father of the 10th generation, David. And what we're looking at is the redemption of Tamar by Ruth. And yet it maintains that whole theme throughout. Men don't care about widows. And even Tamar, in the end, had to be redeemed. Tamar, the precedental widow of Scripture, ultimately was redeemed by a widow, by Ruth. And it was Ruth and her union with righteous Boaz that gave this 10 generations that saw the curse of Tamar finally eliminated. And that's the closing words of the Book of Ruth. And it's a magnificent crescendo of achievement through leading lady Ruth, redeeming the leading lady Tamar. So there's really a lot of beauty and power in these leading lady stories. I wish I'd looked at them many, many years before. Time is pressing. Let's move on. There's one more weird little story, as we know, concerning Tamar. And it's the story of her pregnancy and birth, and it sounds like a very painful and awful, actually, but from a spiritual perspective, we're given to know these details. There were twins in Tamar's womb. When she was in labor, one put his hand out, and the midwife tied on a scarlet thread, saying, "This one was first. This is the real firstborn." But he drew back his hand, and the other came out before him and said, "How you have broken out against your brother." Therefore, his name was called Breakout, or in Hebrew, Peretz. And afterward, his brother, who had been the firstborn initially, came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and so they called his name Scarlet, or Zira. So Scarlet is the rightful firstborn in human terms, but in this case, we're shown this strange story, God allows Peretz, Breakout, to displace Scarlet, and in fact, Messiah's line will come through Ruth and through Tamar, as we know, through this secondborn who kind of broke out and exceeded the firstborn. Simple question, why? What an absolutely complicated story. What on earth do we really need to know any of that for? Why are these details preserved thousands of years down the line? And the reason I suggest to you is, amongst other things, it will teach us about Rahab and the birth of the nation of Israel. Now, what will it teach us? Well, maybe it's time to segue straight into our little second half story, into the life of Rahab. So we've got time to just glimpse a little bit of the life of Rahab. And we won't need a reading here. That's a well-known story. And I've entitled this Midwife in Israel. Now, so, warning alert, possible crazy idea coming at you. But I am going to suggest to you right now that Rahab, who's known as a prostitute, which is very unfortunate, even though it's a reality, Rahab's role, if we look at the Bible with spiritual eyes, Rahab's role was to be the midwife of the birth of Israel. Israel as a nation, Rahab was God's chosen midwife. Raise your hand if anyone suggested that to you ever before, because I think, yep, okay, so have maximum alert. Very suspicious idea coming at you. I'm going to try and justify it. The spies hide out in Rahab's house. We know the story, right? Joshua's about to invade Israel. They must be very tense because they're 40 years down the line from having done this before and failed. So it must be a very nervous time. And Joshua sends spies into the country, which of course makes perfect sense because that's what he did 40 years before. So he knows the value of spies' intelligence. The spies go into the city of Jericho and they stay in Rahab the prostitute's house. Now we might raise an eyebrow at how unseemly that is, but actually that's a very intelligent place for two foreigners to stay without being detected. It's about the one place they can stay where someone would suggest, yeah, that's where a couple of traveling foreigners might well hang out for the night. And they hang out, and Rahab's house is on the city wall, as this one is in northern Italy, where you can drop down from the windows and escape the city. The king of Jericho finds out, however, so the surreptitiousness doesn't work too well, and he questions Rahab. But Rahab has hidden the spies and deceives the king. So, to state the screamingly obvious, Rahab has shown her allegiance early on. She is allied with the God of Israel. She is allied with Yahweh, the God of Israel. That's the obvious point. The less obvious point is the fact that in hiding these Hebrew spies, in protecting these Hebrew men who need her protection, she's in charge here, she's the leading lady, and in lying to the king, a worthy lie in the sense of preserving the will of God, whom does she remind you of? Where have you heard this story before? Excellent. Where did that voice come from? The midwives in Egypt. Well said indeed. Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, this is not the midwives in Egypt, I'm repeating the first bit, bring forth the men that have come to you. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. Rahab hides the spies, resists the king, deceives the king, exactly the same as the midwives in Egypt, as you so rightly said. When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, kill him. But if it's a daughter, you can let her live. But the midwives feared God. They chose Yahweh and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but let the male children live. And they made up some excuse about, oh, well, you know, the Hebrew women are so vigorous, by the time we come to deliver the child, they've already whisked them away and we can't do anything about it. The midwives hide the babies, resist the king, deceive the king. So this isn't all-encompassing and all-powerful, but we see that Rahab is in the same role as the midwives in Egypt, the Hebrew midwives. So there's a comparison there. That doesn't prove anything and everything, but Rahab is in the midwife role as she delivers, and I don't want to make too much of a pun out of the word deliver, but as she delivers those two spies from death. Interesting, you see king of Egypt here, right? It should be, I mean, the Bible is used to using the word Pharaoh, but it says king of Egypt, which is a nice match, or gives you a little hint of king of Jericho, just to allow you, to assist you, to spot the two phrases being the same. Rahab brought the two spies up to the roof and hid them with the in the plants, with the stalks of flax. So there are four people actually hidden in that photo that you're looking at, that she'd laid out in order on the roof. Hidden in the plants. Where have we seen hidden in the plants? And this verb used in this construction is only twice in the Bible. And the other one is actually, not quite, we could guess, when Jochebed could hide Moses no longer. She got a papyrus basket and placed it among the reeds. So it's the same verb. Jochebed hides the hope of Israel in the reeds on the river, and Rahab hides the hope of Israel, the spies, in the plants on the roof. So Jochebed, of course, is not quite a midwife. She became Moses' nurse, even though she was already his mother, became employed as his nurse through a clever ruse. And Rahab then is seen as in the same role that Jochebed plays to Moses, linked by this little language. It's only a very small point. Here comes a much more convincing one. Have a look at this. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelite army the second time. Not, they haven't been circumcised already. It's just that's the previous generation that should have done it. So they're not circumcised. Speaking as a human, speaking as a fool, as it were, this is a terrible time to circumcise the army. They haven't fought the battle yet. The last thing you should do is circumcise a bunch of men before they're supposed to go fight something. It's really not a good idea. However, there's a possibility God knows what he's doing. I'll allow that. When are you supposed, according to the Mosaic law, when are you supposed to be circumcised? On the eighth day after birth. Or, may I say the same thing a different way, on the eighth day after the midwife's delivery. Right. Now, when were they circumcised? Here in Joshua 4, it's actually on the 10th of Abib. The Bible curiously bothers to give us the exact day after they crossed the River Jordan and were circumcised. And you might say, what are the odds that you can count back 8 days? Very low, because usually in the Bible, chronology is extremely hard to pin down. You usually get phrases like sometime later, you know, which means something between half an hour and 12 generations, and you've got absolutely no idea what's going on. However, how curious that between Joshua chapter 2 and Joshua chapter 4 and 5, the days are all carefully numbered for you so that if you're looking very closely, you can actually count them. It's quite easy to do. That then is going to be the eighth day after when God sees the birth of his nation. If we count back 7 days, we find the day that God considers when Israel was born. How interesting was that? Whatever we might choose, well, Israel actually camped 3 days at the Jordan before the crossing. And I'll put the references so you can check them later. Israel camped 3 days at the Jordan before they crossed over and were circumcised. So they, counting backwards, are days 7, 6, and 5. And before they camped at the Jordan River, they camped there after they'd heard the report from the spies, but the spies had camped or hidden 3 days in the hills after they left Rahab. So those must be days 4, 3, and 2. So the day that Israel were born was the day before the spies started camping in the hills, which is the day Rahab delivered them. So God sees Israel's birth as the day Rahab, the midwife, delivered his spies, assuming that God keeps his own law and that he circumcises them on the eighth day. And that's why they're circumcised when they are. And who cares when they're circumcised? I don't care about that. What I care about is now I understand who Rahab is. It's very quietly written in the text. She is the midwife to the entire nation's birth. This is an enormous role. Let us never again just write her off as some Canaanite prostitute. That might be true, but she's the Canaanite prostitute that had faith enough for God to say, "That's the person I want to deliver my nation." Rahab is Israel's midwife, I put it to you. And if that's not convincing enough, guess what? Rahab tied the scarlet cord on Canaanite Jericho. Tying the scarlet cord. Let's then compare the two women we have, we're right at the end, really coming to the end here, between Tamar and Rahab. The scarlet cord is tied on the firstborn. So in Tamar's case, that is the young baby called Zerah, or Scarlet. And in Rahab's case, that's Canaan's Jericho. So can you see the role that's coming in here? Can you see what's happening? Zerah was displaced, pushed out of the firstborn's role by God's will. So what's going to happen to the Canaanites in Jericho? This isn't some genocidal invasion from ancient history, as a modern analyst would write Israel out. This is the hand of God through the very careful and clever introduction of the scarlet cord. The scarlet cord wasn't tied on by Tamar herself. She was in labor. The scarlet cord was tied by the midwife. In Tamar's case, Tamar's midwife. Who tied the scarlet cord? Rahab. So once again, Rahab is in the midwife role. This is the fourth piece of evidence now that's piled up, and I think we've got enough to be confident here. The second son then breaks out against the first. In Tamar's case, that's the man called Breakout, or Peretz. He breaks out against the rightful firstborn, in human terms, and overtakes him. And that's where Israel stands. The nation of Israel breaks out against Canaan, and has God's authority through Tamar's life to displace the Canaanites in the land. And God chooses that breakout son to be the line of his Messiah. It's Perez who will lead to the line of Christ. It is Israel, not Canaan, who will lead to the line of Christ. What then is the scarlet cord? The scarlet cord is the symbol of God's exceptional authorization for a newcomer, for a second son, for a second arrival, to rightfully displace the original people. And we learn then Rahab is God's chosen midwife for his people, as revealed in the life of Tamar. Again, we have one leading lady contributing to the explanation and the justification and the authorization of one of the others. Let's just review that evidence that we had so we can be clear on it. The Hebrew midwives resisted and deceived the king of Egypt. Rahab did the same thing in the midwife role. She resisted and deceived the king of Jericho. Again, notice how the women are leading here. They're controlling, they're protecting the men. These midwives are protecting male babies. The female babies were safe anyway. It's the male babies who are at risk. And so these spies actually come in the role of defenseless babies, which they are essentially as two men only in a city of enemies. And Rahab protects them. Jochebed, the nurse, hides Moses in the plants of the river. And it's Rahab who hides the spies in the plants on the roof. Rahab has this, again, pseudo-midwife, wet nurse, whatever, role. The law calls for males to be circumcised 8 days after the midwife delivers them, and God calls Israel to be circumcised 8 days after Rahab delivers the spies. Very compelling evidence this is, at least to me. You'll let me know afterwards what you think yourself. And Tamar's midwife ties the scarlet cord on the firstborn Zerah, and Rahab ties the scarlet cord on Canaanite Jericho. Four independent pieces of evidence, all giving us a sense of exactly who Rahab is in God's plan. She's Israel's midwife. And so overall, as we see the wonderful plan that God has to bring his nation Israel to fruition, Moses plays this huge role. Even evil Pharaoh is utilized by God to play an important role in establishing the nation of Israel. And Joshua, perhaps most importantly of all, is the one who leads them successfully into the land of conquest. But even Rahab has her place, is one of the cogs in God's plan. We can now see her as someone who's not just some faithful woman who happened to be on the fringes and was saved by a battle. She wasn't saved by the nation of Israel in the battle. She delivered Israel in the first place. It's the other way around. That's how you can see how amazing some of these leading ladies are. Who then is Rahab? My final slide. Who is Rahab? Is she a Canaanite prostitute? Absolutely. But that's an earthly truth, and I'm using my earthly eyes just to see earthly truths. If so be that I can have heavenly eyes, I can also see that Rahab is God's chosen midwife. And so if someone comes up to me randomly and says, so who's Rahab then? I can give two answers. Both are true. And the answer that I give doesn't tell me, doesn't tell them who Rahab is. The answer I give tells someone who I am. Am I the man who uses earthly eyes, or am I the man who uses heavenly eyes? Which man, before these leading ladies, do I want to be? Thank you.